Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with our analysts today, Donna Hoffman, associate professor and chair of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. And there with you in the studio, Chris Larimer, associate professor of political science in your department of political science there at the University of Northern Iowa. Chris, great to have you on board as well.
Thanks. Good to be here, Ben.
Chris, we're going to lean on you heavily a little bit later to talk a little bit about this this shift in the Cook Political Report, shifting the Iowa gubernatorial race from advantage Republicans to 50-50 odds, a toss-up between Kim Reynolds and Fred Hubble. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. But let's tackle, first of all, the breaking news within the last few minutes. The president is preparing and to issue an executive order as soon as later today that ends the separation of families at the border by indefinitely detaining parents and children. Reading from the New York Times web page, the front page right now, it says it's unclear how Mr. Trump intends to claim the authority to violate what would have been legal constraints on the proper treatment of children in government custody. Donna, these last few days have been very interesting, very emotional for some people. Talk about what you have seen happen in the last few days in this the children being separated from families issue.
Well, we can go back a little further than that, Ben, because this policy actually started with Trump, so it also makes sense that it can end with Trump. So on April 6th of this year, Trump signed a memorandum. It was directed to the Secretaries of State and Defense and Justice, Health and Human Services, Department of Homeland Security, and it requested that they take steps to end what was called the catch-and-release program. Now, technically, there is no catch-and-release program. That's kind of a term that's just used for some of the practices that have been used in immigration policy by multiple administrations. And on that very day, on April 6th, is when Jeff Sessions, who's the Secretary of, or excuse me, the Attorney General, issued another memo to prosecutors on the southwest border. And that is what directed them to essentially dispense with any prosecutorial discretion that they were exercising here. And that is how we ended up where we are. And so while the administration has gone through various discussions about where this policy came from, why it's needed, and even what the rationale for it is, it has been the case that it is not a policy that came from other administrations. It started in April and May of this particular year. And so the administration can change the policy. Now, how Trump is exactly going to do that, because as you mentioned, there are some policies, court rulings, other laws, various things that set out some parameters here, but there's also still a lot of discretion. So it'll be interesting to see what form this, it may be an executive order. This originally began with a memorandum. It's important for us to understand that whether a president issues an executive order or a memorandum, they have the same effect. They're what we call unilateral executive actions, and presidents can do quite a bit within these. They can't, you know, go around the law, but they can mm-hmm. do quite a bit, and it started with that.
Mm-hmm. And I think specifically what you're referring to, and I'm reading from the New York Times again, that there's a 1997 consent decree known as the Flores Amendment or Settlement that prohibits the federal government from keeping children in immigration detention, even if they are with their parents for more than 20 days. So a consent decree?
Right. Well, so and that, but that does not require separation. And the Obama administration was trying to detain families whole, and they got a clarification of that Flores settlement. And that is then what they were operating under in terms of families could only be detained for short periods of time. one of the problems we have on the border is there's not enough personnel in terms of immigration law judges, detention centers to hold all of the people who may be seeking asylum or whatever their unique circumstances may be to process all of these people quickly. And so oftentimes there's quite the backlog here. And that's not going to go away with this policy that we have in place that apparently is going to change. There's still going to be that backlog. Senator Cruz did talk about one of the solutions that potentially could be done in Congress was to hire more immigration judges. Trump was very critical of that in some off-the-cuff comments yesterday or the day before about immigration law judges. And so it'll be interesting to see exactly what this memo or executive order does.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the past few days, this has evolved, and the president coming out with the latest chapter here within the last few minutes of forming and preparing to issue an executive order later today. But the refrain from the president has been to blame Congress, more specifically Democrats in Congress. Donna, do you see that holding water?
No, because the Democrats don't control Congress. The president's party controls Congress. Now, while it is true, the Republicans in the Senate have a small majority, and today most things have to be done through a cloture vote, which requires 60 votes to shut off debate. But that doesn't mean that the Democrats are able to, one, move the agenda, for example. The Republicans control that. The Republicans control the levers here. And so it's fairly disingenuous to say this is the Democrats' fault.
Mm-hmm. A huge reaction, not only from within our country, but also from outside of our borders. And the Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, now becoming the most visible defender of these efforts to discourage illegal immigration. She was last night, viral video, heckled by protesters while eating dinner at a Mexican restaurant in Washington, D.C. Let's listen to a little bit of the Homeland Security Secretary. Here she is being asked about comments from first ladies, including Laura Bush and Melania Trump, critical of separating children from their parents at the border.
My response would be is calling attention to this matter is important. This is a very serious issue that has resulted after years and years of Congress not taking action. So I would thank them both for their comments. I would thank them both for their concerns. I share their concerns, but Congress is the one that needs to fix this.
Okay, and also GOP congressional members being critical of this as well. Our own Senator Grassley, critical of separating children and parents. Here's what he said yesterday.
I want the Flores Agreement repealed so that we don't have family separation, because I don't think we should have family separation, and we don't need to have.
Okay, Donna, what is the chord that was struck here that seems to have not been anticipated by this administration?
Well, you know, there are differing rationales that they give for why they were doing this. And one of the rationales, which Kirstjen Nielsen specifically said was offensive, I think, in one of her press conferences. But one of the rationales, and this was linked back to the chief of staff, Kelly, even when he was DHS secretary before Nielsen, was that this would help give them some leverage, these separations that were going to take place. And that is something that Trump can use to try to get Congress to give him in a comprehensive immigration bill more funding for the border wall, et cetera. Various people in the administration have either said, yeah, this is true, like Kelly or like Miller. Other people like Nielsen have said, no, that's offensive. Paul Ryan, I saw a statement from him saying that was ridiculous. Trump, you know, again, has said that it's a Democrat's fault. So there are different rationales for why and how this has been taking place. So the administration hasn't exactly all been on board in terms of what's happening here. And I think that's somewhat indicative of maybe a lack of looking for unintended consequences. Because, you know, when Sessions issues his memo in April, it doesn't say this is what we're going to do. This is an unintended consequence of the fact that we're going to criminally prosecute these people, which means that you can't have minors in the detention with the parents. And so then, by definition, these minors become unaccompanied minors, and then they're treated in this particular manner. So there are some unintended consequences here at one level. Other people say, no, this is exactly what they wanted to intended to give them some leverage with Congress. It remains to be seen exactly, you know, what the case is. And I think you've got different actors in the administration doing all of these things or thinking about these consequences in different ways. They're just not all on the same page, it would seem.
Mm-hmm. Americans reacting to this in the latest poll by CNN conducted by SSRS, 2/3 of Americans disapproving of the administration's practice of taking undocumented immigrant children from their families, putting them in government facilities on U.S. borders. 28% approve, but among Republicans, still a majority, near 60% support for the policy. I wonder when we talk about, will there be an aftermath, a political consequence, a price to pay, Donna? Can this administration shift blame to the Democrats? Is there a fair share of criticism for inaction on immigration that belongs also to the Democrats?
Well, again, I would point to the fact that both the presidency and the Senate and the House are controlled by the Republicans. Trump earlier created a dilemma for his own party in Congress when, he said Congress has to fix DACA, for example, and they still have not been able to do that because how Congress functions is through compromise. And that doesn't mean that you always have to be compromising with the opposition party, but even within the Republican conference in the House of Representatives, they can't agree on how they want to go forward. Witness what they're going to be doing tomorrow. They've got two bills. One's being called a hard right bill, and the other one's being called a compromise bill. And that compromise bill is between the Republican leadership, the more moderate members of the Republican House, and some of the hardliners. And so they're not even all on the same page within the conference what to do in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer, your thoughts on what's been happening in immigration the last few days?
Well, I think what we've seen is that the Democrat, or at least the Republicans, have started to realize that this issue was essentially handing the Democrats an easy issue on which to campaign for the 2018 midterms. You know, we've talked in the past about how strong partisanship is, and that for most campaigns, it's less about persuasion and it's more about mobilization. This issue, the negative press surrounding it, the images, the stories of children suffering, was essentially handing the Democrats an easy issue on which to campaign this fall, and it was going to be used as a mobilization tactic, right? If this is an issue, because it's such a hot-button issue, Democrats were going to be able to use this as a way to get out voters who maybe don't normally vote in a midterm but are disgusted by what they're seeing every day in the press surrounding, you know, the suffering of children, the separation of children from parents. And so it was giving the Democrats an issue on which to campaign. And I think Republicans started to realize that this was going to create some backlash, that this had the potential to mobilize either Democrats who don't normally vote in a midterm election or independent voters who maybe lean Democratic to show up in 2018 and potentially hurt the Republicans' chances going into the midterms.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, you seem to be saying that this executive order is a sort of damage control.
Oh, I think it is. I think, like I said, it's trying to move past the issue, move past an issue that was clearly trending in the wrong direction for Republicans. That in the poll you mentioned, you know, it's not just Democrats, it's independents who are clearly upset by what they see going on with this policy, what the images and stories are seeing coming out from the border. And so I think it absolutely is damage control for the Trump administration. The fact that he could have that significant of a reversal that Donna mentioned in his policies from April to mid-June, I think it clearly is damage control by the administration.
Right. We have to remember, only a couple days ago that Kirstjen Nielsen of Homeland Security said only Congress alone can solve this problem. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out, we'll see at the end of the day. We're expecting the signing of that executive order. What the president can do, he can also undo. But also getting back to this as a campaign issue, who knows with the velocity of the news cycle these days, how much this will be on voters' minds in over 4 months from now. But the percentage of Americans who say immigration is the most pressing issue facing the country has risen, according to a Gallup poll that was released yesterday. Gallup reporting that 14% of Americans think that immigration is the most important problem facing the U.S. That's up from 10% in the same poll in May. 19% when we cluster a few together, 19% say that poor leadership, government incompetence, or dysfunction were together the top issue facing the U.S. So Donna, will this immigration has endured for a decade at least in our list of top considerations in this country? Will this be a major issue, do you think, enduring over the next few months for voters?
It will be an issue, but, you know, most voters aren't policy voters. They are voting based on partisanship. There are a core group of voters for whom this issue will be very important, both on the right and on the left. And so I do think that, I mean, we're not going to solve this problem. We've got problems on the border. We've had them for 20 years or more. Congress has tried to address comprehensive immigration reform in the Bush administration, in the Obama administration. So by the time November rolls around, this problem is not going to be fixed. Now, there may be less attention being paid to it, and that's going to affect some of the, like, the polling that you're talking about in some respects, because these things were going on and the media just started reporting on them and people just started seeing them. So certainly it's going to be an issue. Is it going to be the primary issue for many voters? Probably not. Because there are, again, voters oftentimes voting based on partisanship. And while that is attached to policy issues, you know, if you're a Democrat, you basically know what the Democrats stand for. If you're a Republican, you basically know what the Republicans stand for. It's a small number of people for whom a single issue like this is going to be the main vote getter. But it is also important that, as Chris mentioned, this is one of those issues that can be an easy issue that could activate some people who might be paying less attention to politics, who typically don't vote in the midterms, as he mentioned. And that's more about activation.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman with us, if you've just joined us, of the University of Northern Iowa, along with her colleague Chris Larimer, also of the University of Northern Iowa. Join our conversation. We discuss the immigration situation on this Politics Wednesday, 1-866-780-9100. Tom is with us, joining us from Des Moines. Tom, thanks for listening. What do you want to chip into the conversation you're hearing?
Yes, I had a couple of comments about the media coverage of this, children being separated from their migrant parents. I have not heard the media so willing to use language of falsehood about what the administration is saying, and I hope he'll continue this, because the Trump administration has been very openly false about a lot of things, but never have I heard more willingness to use the language of lying and falsehood than I have over this particular issue. And the second comment is that the media seems to be so preoccupied with this issue. I get the sense that it's kind of sensationalizing things, and I really didn't understand what was going on until I listened to IPR and PBS for 3 or 4 days, and while I attempted to dissect this issue. But it seems to be too much coverage of this issue. We need to hear about other things as well. So mm-hmm. I'll take my comments off the air.
Tom, thank you for your points about the media here, too. As has happened for more than a year, we have so many sort of blaring headlines to discuss it. It does leave some other very, very important issues in the shadows, not discussed as much as we would like. That's a personal note from me. But Chris, comment on the comments that Tom had on the media coverage of this issue in particular.
Well, I think he's right in the sense that this has been kind of the number one issue for the media the last few days. And when anytime you have family issues or issues with children, I mean, that's going to get attention because that resonates on an emotional level with voters. Right.
Right. You have a picture of a toddler crying and holding the hand of a gloved ICE agent, right?
Exactly. And Donna mentioned, right, that the voters are not policy voters. Voters vote based on partisanship, but voters are also very emotional, right? We remember images. We're not going to remember policy details. And so it makes sense, you know, the media is focusing on an emotional aspect to this particular issue, and that's what voters are going to remember. And so I think, you know, it sort of makes sense that that's what you're seeing. And, of course, that's what voters are remembering, too, right, of those images. We've talked about this on other shows, whether or not there's a power to images of human suffering. And, you know, there's some research that suggests if that human suffering is removed, if it's far off, it may not have a significant effect on attitudes or behavior. But if it's close in proximity, in this case, it's something that's happening in our own country, I think you do see it resonating with voters. And that's why it seems like the media is preoccupied with this particular issue.
Mm-hmm. Donna, can I ask you to comment on Tom's remark about press reports saying this is a false claim by the president that the Democrats created this. Now, that I don't know how much you want to observe about the press and changing under this president.
Well, I think one of the interesting things to watch here will be, is this kind of the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, where the media says we're going to call a lie a lie, because they have been reluctant to do that. There are various political fact checkers and things that one can go to. The Washington Post, I believe, is tallying the falsehoods of the Trump of Trump himself, and it's up to 3,000 something. So they have been doing that, but I think the qualitative difference that you're getting that Tom is noticing is it being in the lead paragraph, it may be even being in the headline that this is a falsehood, that this is a lie. And it may be that this is the turning point because of the emotional intensity of this issue for the media. It may be that kind of after this issue maybe fades a little bit, they go back to equivocating a bit more in terms of how they're characterizing this. I think it'll be an interesting thing to watch as to whether in the future we could pinpoint maybe this issue as a turning point in terms of how the media is covering the administration.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute or two before we go to break here, too. Do either of you have comments, other comments, perhaps comments on the international reaction to what's been happening here in the U.S. In terms of ethics? And these have been called human rights abuses. Do they qualify?
Well, I think that's something that, you know, when we get crosswise with our allies, which we have done in some respects in recent months, it may help politicians abroad with their home audience to criticize the United States. And the United States has typically stood for human rights and been an international actor in human rights. And where a country who may be a disgruntled ally or even an enemy can point to something and say, well, see, look, the Americans are a bunch of hypocrites. They do these kinds of things, too. That's problematic. And it's particularly problematic in terms of American leadership in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we go, we haven't talked at all about the congressional Democrats here. They were asked to, but have not at all been willing to help out, help the president out here in getting out of this situation, Chris, right?
No, and I think that makes sense. And in part, it goes back to Donna's point about that the Republicans control the agenda. They control what issues are brought up on the floor of the House or the Senate. And so there, from a political standpoint, there really is no incentive for Democrats to reach out at this point. They can make the argument that they've tried in the past. They've tried bipartisan agreements in the past to try to get some movement on the immigration issue, and Republicans have sort of stonewalled them. So I think they're sitting back and kind of letting the issue unfold as it is.
Okay.
And I would add here, Ben, that Schumer in particular has said the president created this problem, the president can fix it, and now that's actually what we see happening with this executive order potentially.
And that won't be the last time we'll hear, I bet, Chuck Schumer echo that now based on today's news. He'll make hay, we can guess. Chris Larimer with us, the Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor and Chair of Political Science at UNI. We'll be back with Donna and Chris in just a moment. We're going to shift gears, go a little bit more local, and talk about how the governor's race between Kim Reynolds and Fred Hubbell is now a toss-up. That's according to the Cook Political Report. The edge was given before to Republicans. Now it's a toss-up. We'll ask Chris Larimer why when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
So good to have you on board midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. New data from the CDC shows Iowa's suicide rate increased more than 35% in 17 years, along with a lot of other states. Tomorrow on this program, we'll ask what's behind the dramatic rise in the suicide rate in Iowa and across the nation. We'll also look at access to mental health care across the state and learn what you can do when a loved one is severely depressed. Tomorrow, suicide prevention and mental health care access. Today, Politics Wednesday with Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa and his colleague, Donna Hoffman. And we enjoy having you join in with your comments as we discuss a variety of topics. Last half hour, talking about the breaking news we heard within the last hour or so about the immigration issue, which has been heating up in recent days. The president is evidently preparing to issue an executive order that ends the separation of families by indefinitely detaining parents and children together. We'll see what the details are of that when that executive order is issued, supposed to be sometime today. Cade, sorry if I didn't get your name right, writes in reaction to our last half-hour conversation, your guests are right. In order for this immigration issue to factor into the elections, it will be a matter of voter activation. I think it is unlikely Republican voters will leave their representatives over this issue, especially with the issue being framed more towards the president than Congress. Well, let's move on to talk about the governor's race, which is just a couple of weeks old now that we know the matchup in the governor's race between Kim Reynolds and Fred Hubble since our primary here in Iowa. It's been judged to be now a toss-up, according to the Cook Political Report. Before the primary, the Cook Political Report had advantage to the Republicans, advantage Kim Reynolds. Chris Larimer, you've been looking at this. What is the explanation?
Well, I think the only explanation at this point is the one thing that's changed, and that we know who the Democratic nominee is and that it's going to be Fred Hubble. I think, you know, before the primary, it was, as you said, advantage Republican. It was actually rated as likely Republican, and now it's moved over to toss-up, which actually skips over the rating of lean Republican. And so I think what's changed is who the nominee is. I think, you know, what's also being factored in there is the results of that primary, that Fred Hubble not only went over the 35% mark, but he exceeded it by, I think, nearly 20 percentage points. And that he's obviously a very well-financed candidate, can be a self-financed candidate, is starting to build name recognition where he didn't have it before the race, even though, or before the primary election, he already had relatively good name recognition, certainly in Des Moines, but he's starting to build that out. And so I think what they're looking at is the fact that this is a well-financed, relatively well-known candidate who clearly excited his own party in the primary and is now going to be going up against Governor Reynolds. And as Donna and I were talking before the show, you know, Governor Reynolds obviously is the current governor, but she's not your typical incumbent in that she was elected to her position. She's actually running for election for the first time.
Right, and we have to make sure we remember it's not correct to call her an incumbent, right?
That's correct, right? She is someone who is appointed to or elevated to that position. And so all of the things that we know about the incumbency advantage or the advantage of incumbents in Iowa, particularly when it comes to governors, may not necessarily apply to this particular election. And so you look at some of the, you know, what's already out there, you know, partisanship in the state hasn't changed. The issues on which Democrats are going to campaign haven't really changed. What's changed is that we know who the Democratic nominee is now.
Okay, let's hear the voices of the two major party nominees for governor. One of these two, we think, will be the next governor of Iowa, or continue to be governor if it's Kim Reynolds. Governor Reynolds touting her Republican legislative accomplishments at the Republican Party of Iowa convention on Sunday. Okay, that was evidently audio from the very back row of that particular venue. Let's listen to her opposition, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubble, formally announcing State Senator Rita Hart as his running mate, and this was Saturday at the Iowa Democratic Convention.
We consider a lot of talented Iowans, was Senator Hart always stood out, and I couldn't be more excited to have her as my running mate. Her story as a teacher for over 20 years, a farmer, a mother of five, a grandmother, two-term state senator, is a strong testament to her strong character. A caring, steadfast Iowan through and through, Senator Hart has dedicated her life to serving and fighting for her community. We're running in this race because we both love this state, and we want to leave it to all of our children and grandchildren better than we found it. And Senator Hart just had a new grandchild, so I know how committed she is to that vision.
Hubble Hart would be the ticket there. Chris, tell us about this pick. Fred Hubble picking Rita Hart, state senator, as he mentioned there, former teacher, farmer, as a running mate in his bid to topple Kim Reynolds.
Well, I think this gets at one of the things we've talked about before with the candidacy of Fred Hubble, is that he was going to have appeal in Des Moines, but he's also a Des Moines Democrat, and we've talked about before that sometimes that makes it difficult to campaign statewide, particularly in a midterm election year where turnout is down in Iowa compared to a presidential election year. So his challenge was always going to be on a more personal level, in my opinion, in terms of reaching out to rural voters. How does he make himself feel relatable to rural voters, and how do rural voters feel about a campaign or a candidate like Fred Hubble? Each party had their own advantage going into this election, right? For the Republicans, it was a midterm election year, and we know that turnout is down in a midterm year. But for Democrats, their advantage was that this was a midterm year where a Republican occupies the White House, and we know that that has an effect on congressional elections, but that also does have an effect on gubernatorial elections. And right now, you know, as we know, President Trump's approval ratings are right now in the low 40s, and so for Fred Hubble, what he needs to do for his campaign is get out there and, you know, relate to rural Iowans, relate to rural Democrats throughout the state. And so picking someone like State Senator Rita Hart is his attempt to do that. We know, you know, she was born in Charles City. She's a state senator from Clinton County. Obviously, is not going to be well known at this point. And she's not going to be, a pick for lieutenant governor is not going to persuade Republicans to vote Democratic, but what she can do is try to, back to our point from the first part of the show, is she can help try to mobilize the base, mobilize those Democratic voters who maybe are intermittent voters who don't necessarily vote regularly in a midterm election, but maybe feel more comfortable about Fred Hubble's candidacy because of Rita Hart being on the ticket.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation with Chris Larimer and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go to our phones quickly. Troy is in Iowa City. Hi, Troy. Coming to the end of our program. What point do you want to make or question?
Yes. My question is it more important to have a woman as governor or a rich man as governor? Will more Democrat women vote for a woman, or will they support a very rich man?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know if we can answer that categorically. Donna, do you want to tackle that?
Sure. I would think that partisanship trumps that in this particular case. But one of the things also about Rita Hart that's interesting, beyond the fact of her gender, we talked about her rural background, but she's also a teacher. She has a background there, and many of the accomplishments that we heard Governor Reynolds tout in her comments at the convention are things that are somewhat controversial. And in particular, changes to Chapter 20 affected a lot of people in the education field, and Rita Hart potentially can speak to that. And so, you know, it's up to voters, to get back to the caller's point, as to whether it's important that Fred Hubble is rich or not. Or that he's male, the identification in terms of partisanship, as we've talked about a couple of times earlier today on the show, are things that are going to help voters position themselves. And then there's other things that can activate them as well. And so, you know, Fred Hubble in picking a woman helps him in the regard of that he's running against a sitting female governor.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to voters, though, to decide, well, what are the characteristics that I want to see Is it going to be partisanship? Is it going to be a particular issue? Because, you know, there, while there aren't very many issue voters, there are a few. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we generally see partisanship being most important.
And I think, if I could, Ben, I think what Donna makes a really good point here. I think one of the what we probably anticipate to be the number or one of the top issues going into this election is collective bargaining. And it's probably it was certainly going to be a little bit difficult for Fred Hubbell to talk about being personally affected by collective bargaining. But certainly his running mate, Rita Hart, can talk about being personally affected by collective bargaining. So she has a direct link to potentially the number one issue for this campaign.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Chris in Des Moines, welcome to the program. Coming up to the end of the hour, I'll ask you to get right to the point, but welcome to the program, Chris in Des Moines.
Well, thank you. I'll get right. What I wanted to bring up yesterday, the governor had a thing out at the Women's Correctional Facility called the Public Safety Forum. And one of the things, I went to it, and I hate that I, on one hand, I'm glad I went, the other hand, I hated that I did go because it was a waste of time. It was not a forum, for one. And so this governor is going to be calling things that it isn't, and then have how they structured it. It was supposed to be, they wanted to have all people from all walks of life to come together to talk about public safety. But when you got there, it was nothing like what they said. It was just they had a forum of people to talk to the people that are there, but it was no communication back and forth. Mm. And so the thing is, if this governor is going to play games like that with people, it was ridiculous. We have racism, discrimination that is running rapid, and with them issues, but they did not want to talk about it there. It was we couldn't talk about it.
Okay,
I just wanted to bring that up.
Let's get reaction from our guest, Chris in Des Moines. It sounds like you're well engaged politically. That is commendable, Chris in Des Moines. What about that observation? Of course, this is one person's view, Donna, holding an event, a public safety forum, if I understood that correctly.
Right. Well, we do know, and Chris has written about this in his book, that Iowans like that personal touch. And so this may be something that... Chris Larimer, to my right here, that Iowans do like to be able to see their incumbents in particular. And if forums aren't really forums and they're presented that way, that can be a problem in terms of addressing issues. And, you know, one of the things that Governor Branstad had was an ability to go out across the state often and talk to voters. And that may just have been his style, and Kim Reynolds may have a different style, but she needs to factor in, you know, this particular caller's comments, because obviously he's not satisfied with the forum that was held.
Mm-hmm. Back to what was mentioned by a caller I wanted to get to anyway, and back to the Cook Political Report shifting this race to the toss-up category. Before, it was given to a definite advantage to Reynolds. Let's talk a little bit more about Hubbell's wealth, independently wealthy. He poured $3 million of his own money into the primary challenge. He raised about $4 million more. Reynolds also well-funded, entering the primary season with about $4 million in cash, and according to the information I have. So this is going to be a very expensive race. Chris, I wonder if you think how much that political report shift to toss-up has to do with Hubbell being independently wealthy.
Well, I think it's one of the factors, certainly. And I think it's combined with his overwhelming victory, like I said, in the Democratic primary, that there was a lot of speculation going into that primary about who would the candidates sort of rally behind. And they clearly rallied around Fred Hubbell. You know, turnout was relatively high. It was close to what we saw with the 2014 Republican primary for the United States Senate seat. And so I think it's both factors. But at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of money spent. But what's interesting is I think it's going to come down to more of a qualitative element to this campaign. To Donna's point, this is going to be a very personal campaign. How well can each candidate sell his or her story on the campaign trail? And the way you sell that story is you get out, you talk to voters, you go to those small meetings, you hold the forums where you can interact with voters in a way that they feel comfortable with you.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben, if I might add here, you know, it's kind of interesting. There have been a couple of talking points I would think maybe are being put out about Fred Hubbell's wealth and him being a Democrat. Well, the leader of the Republican Party, President Trump, is also independently wealthy, and Republicans voted for him. So the issue of wealth, I mean, the reality is that in elections in the United States today, at the gubernatorial level in particular, take money. And when you have a competitive race, that tends to attract money coming in from a lot of outside entities as well. So, yeah, we expect this race to be very competitive. We expect the money to pour in from outside entities. But then also Fred Hubbell has the ability to do some self-funding here as well. And he did some of that in the primary. But, you know, we can probably expect that both Kim Reynolds and Fred Hubbell are going to have enough money to wage this campaign.
Mm-hmm. This is a midterm election. Voters coming out or not? Well, they come out mostly in presidential elections, more so in midterms. We know that. Donald Trump, not a terribly popular president, according to approval polling, I think in the lower 40s at this point, having risen a bit in recent weeks. Will Donald Trump have an impact on this race, the governor's race, do you think, Chris?
Well, you know, research on gubernatorial elections would say yes. Presidential approval is typically one of the factors that's included in our models when we're trying to predict the vote share for gubernatorial campaigns or gubernatorial candidates, excuse me, in an election. And typically, if you share party affiliation with an unpopular president, so as his or her approval rating goes down, your percentage vote share goes down. And so I think for Governor Reynolds, that's a factor to overcome. And so, you know, she may have to kind of walk the line as far as the extent to which she embraces the president, because that has the potential to hurt her vote share in November. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, turnout in midterm elections in Iowa is typically, you know, 450,000 fewer voters than you see in a presidential election. And the last two midterm elections in Iowa in 2010 and 2014 have been very big for the Republican Party of Iowa. And so I think, you know, it can kind of go either way there. But you know, on the surface level, yes, presidential approval does matter for gubernatorial elections.
Mm-hmm. And Ben, we might add here that, you know, Trump is pushing tariffs, and we've gotten into this seeming trade war with China in particular. And those tariffs are going to affect disproportionately the state of Iowa in terms of agricultural manufacturing, agriculture production, soybeans, pork, corn. And those are things that Kim Reynolds has to figure out very carefully how she positions herself vis-a-vis the president on, because those are not going to be policies that are popular, policies that are hurting the economy of Iowa.
I wonder, would it, now whether this will happen or not, I have no indication, but Donna, do you think it would help or hurt Governor Reynolds to have Donald Trump support her, come to Iowa to show his support? I don't know if you think that might be a possibility. Chris, comment after Donna does.
Well, I think that's definitely something she could get if she wanted to. You know, Trump says things on the stump that aren't very predictable. And most people running campaigns of this type want a little bit of predictability there. So it would be something the campaign would, I think, calculate pretty carefully because of the uncertainty of how Trump would present himself in the state.
Mm-hmm. Do you think hurt or help Governor Reynolds to have Donald Trump come here and campaign for her, Chris?
Well, I think there's just a lot of uncertainty there. I mean, you think about if you just look at some of the numbers, where if you're talking about party registration in the state, where it's essentially a third, a third, a third, but really no party voters being the dominant faction there within the state, there's a lot of uncertainty with that group of voters, right? There's the potential to help mobilize the Republican base in Iowa, but what percentage of those no party voters are you potentially going to alienate, as Donna said, if President Trump goes off script on a visit to Iowa? So I think it's, you know, you bring in a very large element of uncertainty to that if President Trump would come to the state. Yes, it would be a mobilization, tool for Governor Reynolds' campaign. But again, I don't think that's a risk that campaign necessarily wants to take at this point. If his approval rating starts to trend in the other direction, if it starts to get closer to 50%, particularly if it starts to do a little bit better in Iowa, then there's that potential. But right now, I'd be surprised if that happens before Election Day.
Quickly, before we go, Chris, how much are people really paying attention more than 4 months before the general election?
I'm not sure that the average voter is paying a great deal of attention to the campaign at this point. I think you have to wait until we get to closer to September or October or really August or September, for voters to really start paying attention to this campaign. I think they know who the nominees are at this point. But I think what you're seeing the candidates do right now is really they're still introducing themselves to a lot of voters. That's why they're going around the state. That's why they're holding the small forums or the small meetings, is to try to introduce themselves to voters now so they can keep that personal relationship come fall, when voters are going to be paying a little bit more closer attention.
Well, we are paying attention here at Political Junkies on River to Rivers Politics Wednesday. Chris Larimer, Donna Hoffman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor and Chair of Political Science at UNI. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about suicide prevention and mental health care access in the state. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help today also from Lucy McGeehee and Shirley Wong. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.